All right, we do this every day. We call it The Scoop. It is the headlines that we haven't had a time to get to yet. Brian, you ready to go?
Yes. Okay. Let me just pull it up.
All right. Now, according to our friend Bob Nightingale, baseball beat writers will have a one-hour deadline to complete their game stories when baseball starts back up. That's 1 hour after post-game interviews. You've written a lot of stuff. I talked a lot about how you and your brother Andy write a lot of things for The Athletic. 1 hour after the game, or really after you get out of the locker room, will that give beat writers enough time to do what they need to do?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, everybody's going to have to work on this, you know, understanding, you know, what's different and you know, the new rhythms here, what's going to be reported is different. But the other thing you got to remember, everybody's got these players, you know, if you want to get a player, you can text them, you can call them. Like, there are going to be ways to contact people if you need to.
The other thing is, I've sat next to a lot of beat writers over the years. Most of these guys are writing their story as the game goes along.
Right, you go along.
Yeah,
right.
And you can do all these times, things. A lot of times if there's something happens in the fourth quarter, or, you know, I always think about Kobe's final game, how everybody that was working on that stuff probably had to throw it out because Kobe went nuts in the fourth quarter. But I think an hour is plenty of time, and then they're going to kick everybody out and sanitize the stadium. I think it's yet another part of the new world that we are going to be living in. It's the days, Brian, of you being there until 1 or 2 in the morning are long over. You got to get in, get out, and go home. And I think that's going to be the new way of doing things. Fun. Brian, to you.
All right. So this I thought was kind of crazy. The folks over at Amazon, John, have secured the naming rights for Seattle's downtown arena that will house the new NHL team, as well as the WNBA team up there.
Right.
But the company's name will not appear anywhere on the building. Instead, John, they're calling it Climate Pledge Arena, and it will feature several green initiatives that will go on around the arena. It will be the first zero carbon certification arena. They're going to have recaptured rainwater for the ice. And they're actually trying to figure out ways for people to bring their own rainwater, BYO. I don't know whether they even know how you do that or what that means, but that's what they're doing. It'll be a zero waste place, all this stuff. But the big question I have is, John, does Amazon get value out of having the naming rights and paying the naming rights for the building if there is no name on it?
Well,
Amazon doesn't appear on it.
Yeah, it's a fair question, and I understand why you asked it. But, Brian, if there is one thing I am most sure about in life, in the world today, is that Amazon doesn't need to get value out of anything. They print money. If there's a company that can afford to do this, no, they're not going to get name value or name recognition out of it. But I read an article that Jeff Bezos is the richest man in the world. And when he went through his divorce a couple of years ago, his wife got 25% of what his net worth was, and she's now the third richest person in the United States. So that's how much stupid money Jeff Bezos has. By the way, a couple things about that Seattle arena. A good friend of mine has been working on it for over a year, and he's going to be one of the people that when it opens is going to help run it. And it is going to be spectacular. It's the exact site of the old Key Arena. I don't know if you ever went to a game at the Key Arena back when the Sonics played up there. And as an NBA guy, here's what I'm hoping happens. I don't know if it's going to happen, but I think this would make a lot of geographic sense, okay? Right now, the NBA has 30 teams. So does baseball. As we've learned from the NFL, 32 teams is the perfect number. It's the perfect number for scheduling. It's the perfect number for divisions. It's the perfect number for everything. 32 is you can mix, match, go, do whatever you want with 32 teams. How about this for an idea? Two new NBA expansion franchises. You put one in Las Vegas, where the hockey team is, that's been such a huge success there. You put the other one in Seattle. And then you take New Orleans and Memphis, who are basically on the right hand of a United States map, more closer to the east than they are to the west, especially Memphis, and you put them in the east. That way you lower travel, you line up better geographically, you have 32 teams. I think both those cities support an NBA franchise. What do you think?
I have no problem with that. I mean, I think there's always the concern with any sport that when you expand, you dilute the talent pool in a way that hurts the game. But I think two things are happening right now. I think people are learning how to play the game in ways that are more entertaining, so that some of those issues that you see aren't as big a deal. You get more out of players now than you used to because players are used correct, you know, in ways that maximize them. All this stuff happens. So I don't think you'll see that. And I also think adding Seattle, adding Vegas improves the league so much because you have two really popular cities that'll be destination kind of cities. The NBA, there is not a city in the country that's better for the NBA than Seattle. They love it up there. Players love playing up there. Obviously, Vegas will be a premier destination for the NBA. And so I like the idea. I'm all on board.
All right, Funch. Brian, today the NFL announced that the Cowboys-Steelers preseason opener at the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio on August 6th is being canceled. And the Hall of Fame enshrinement ceremony on August 8th is being postponed due to the pandemic. So now, there is a debate going on around the NFL. Some league officials say you have to have each team play at least two preseason games. They point to using those games as dress rehearsals for how games will be played in the new world and a way to work out the kinks. The other side argues that you shouldn't try and play any more games than you have to, that you're trying to stay ahead of the coronavirus and preseason games are just a waste of time and resources. Brian, what is the right side of that argument?
The people who say that preseason games are actually needed this year because of how different it's going to be are correct. This is actually the one year where preseason games would be beneficial. But the other side just, I mean, completely outweighs it because every time you put players together, every time you stage a game, every time you do something that isn't necessary, you are risking the spread of coronavirus. And so, yeah, I mean, it's going to be kind of weird and awkward. And there's going to be a learning curve in the first couple of weeks of the real season. Might not look so good, but you have to minimize the amount of games, the amount of time and the amount of stuff that you do that puts people together in that way. If you want to try to get through a 17 game NFL season. So, yeah, no preseason.
I've always wondered, Brian, why. Okay, so if you want to make the argument that the NHL or the NBA or even Major League Baseball with spring training need preseason games, you can make the argument. To me, it's always been a little bit of an economic thing that, you know, you can make a lot of money in these preseason games, particularly, you know, I work in the NBA. You can bring your product to cities that don't normally have it. You know, for example, we play preseason games in Vegas almost every year. But in the NFL, I've never understood it. Your injury risk goes way up. And this is even before we had a pandemic. Your injury risk goes way up. Teams like the Rams never, not sometimes, but never play their starters. You will not see Jared Goff or Cooper Kupp or Robert Woods or Aaron Donald. You won't see any of those dudes. It just seems to me like a completely unnecessary exercise. And the reason I know that, Brian, is because college football is a huge success in this country, and they never have preseason games, ever. When they start the season, they start the season. And that's worked fine for 50 years. Get rid of these preseason games. We don't need them. It's a way for you to stick your season ticket holders with an extra bill. You don't need the money from them. You're making enough money hand over fist anyway, especially in a year with the pandemic. I completely agree with you. No preseason. Let's just hit the ground running and start with the regular games. Funch.
All right. John, the Knicks president Leon Rose said this week that he intends to have the franchise's next head coach in place by the end of July. Now, the Knicks, of course, they're not very good. They're not going to be invited down to the Orlando bubble or really anywhere else for the time being. How good of a job right now is the Knicks' job?
All right, this is a great question because, believe it or not, you've been to a game at the Garden, right?
Oh, yeah, a couple. They're unbelievable.
It is. They call it the Mecca for a reason. it's right in the heart of the city. The buzz, the excitement. If the Knicks were even remotely decent, it would be the toughest ticket in the NBA. I mean, people love basketball in New York. So if you could be the person to revitalize that, you'd be immortalized. But I keep thinking, like, for example, I'm a little biased here because I think Jason Kidd, who's been such a great assistant for the Lakers and who I would love to see stay. Well, the Lakers have already granted him permission to go talk to the Knicks about this job. And I want what's best for Jason because I've come to kind of like him. If he got the Knicks job, is that better than getting the Bulls job? I'm not so sure. Is that it's definitely not better than getting the Nets job, but he already had that, so I don't think he can go back to a job right. He's already had.
Doesn't it matter?
But what's a better job, the Bulls or the Knicks?
Whose new management do you trust? Because, you know, it's Leon Rose in New York.
World Wide West. They just hired World Wide West.
But I forget who the new GM in Chicago is. But, like, that's the ownership groups for both of these teams are not well thought of around the league. You know, the Bulls ownership is not well respected. Obviously, Jim Dolan, not well respected in New York. So it really just depends on which ownership group do you trust more and which new management group do you trust more. And I'm not sure you have enough information to know about either because the owner can screw everything up in a moment anyway.
Right. There's only 30 of those jobs. I think if you get offered it, you got to take it. But look at the list of people that Nick's job has chewed up and spit out. Whether it be Lenny Wilkins or Larry Brown or Don Nelson, Mike Woodson. He wasn't the coach, but really Phil Jackson, you know, tried to rebuild that whole thing and failed. If you talk to Derek Fisher or Kurt Rambis, like, you know, local guys who had a crack at that, even though Kurt was an interim guy, they would tell you that it's hard to win when you don't have everybody aligned. You don't have the owner, the GM, and the coach aligned. So your question is the right one. Will the owner give new management a chance to pick their guy and support him? And I would disagree with you about Chicago. I think Jerry Reinsdorf has won multiple NBA titles. He's won a World Series title with the White Sox. He did hire.
That was the last one, John. That was a lot. That team has been a bit of a train wreck for the last 20 years since MJ went away.
Right, but I mean, can't we kind of saddle a lot of that with the late Jerry Krause, who couldn't seem to get out of his own way?
Jerry Krause was not a terrible GM. He tore that team down, but it's like he's been gone for a long time. You know, they've had plenty of opportunities to kind of build it up, and then the Jim Boylan thing did. Like that has not been a well-run organization over the last year. Not Knicks bad, but still pretty bad.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see who takes that job and if they're given like the control and power they need to make it work. Funch. All right, Brian, according to the website The Big Lead, the Angels are the team that would give bettors the best odds if they were looking for a long-shot World Series winner. Superbook USA released their early World Series odds once the news of a season occurring became official. The defending champion Nationals aren't getting much faith, while the Dodgers and Yankees predictably lead the pack. But the Angels, at 20-1, offer some value. A 60-game season means star power matters all the more. Why the Yankees and Dodgers are favorite. But the Angels have the best all-around player in Mike Trout. They added World Series hero Anthony Rendon at third, and they get Shohei Ohtani back to both pitch and hit. Are you buying that the Angels are a good long-shot bet?
Oh, sure. Because in a small sample size, you don't need to be the best team. I actually think this, you know, the Yankees and Dodgers and all this stuff, like these high profile teams, someone's not getting in. Someone's going to struggle for 10 or 15 games or have an injury that doesn't work or whatever, you know, that screws up, you know, this tiny little timeline they have. So I think you're going to see a team like the Angels. The Angels are probably better than one or two teams that are going to get in. You know, like if you go back and look last year, John, the Pirates, 60 games into the season, were near the top of the National League. They didn't stay that way, but they started that way. And so for over 60 games, weird stuff can happen. And the Angels being good, given the two or three or four really good players that they have, that doesn't surprise me at all.
I don't know if they have enough starting pitching. I mean,
but you don't know what they're saying. It's like you don't need, and you have, you even brought it up yesterday. If your bullpen is good enough, and with 60 players, and in starting pitching is going to be devalued this year because guys aren't going to be built up. You're not going to be able to get, you know, you're only getting 10 starts out of your best guys anyway, and those guys probably aren't going to be able to go more than four or five, six innings for the first three or four of those starts anyway. So if you have a good bullpen or you have a lot of depth in your system and you can use that taxi squad well, the fact that you don't have enough starting pitching, probably this is the year. Like, it won't matter as much.
All right, Funch. Brian, last one's to you.
Last one is to me. So the Washington Redskins have removed the name of former owner George Preston Marshall from their Ring of Fame. So, you know, because he was, you know, pretty racist, as it turns out. So the question, though, they already took this statue down. They've now removed him from the Ring of Fame, and all that. But the one thing that they haven't done as an organization is propose changing the name of the thing. Can you do that where you remove all reference to the founder of your team because he was a raging racist, but not actually change the name of your team, which obviously has serious problems in that regard?
I don't think they're going to change the name of the team as long as Daniel Snyder is the owner. And remember, Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner, grew up a Redskins fan. So, I mean, if this was going to happen, it probably would have happened already. I just think Daniel Snyder's one of those guys that he doesn't like being told what to do. It's my way or the highway. He's not changing the name. And barring an ownership change, Brian, I think they'll be the Redskins when you and I leave the earth. I think that it's years away from doing it.
I think you're right. I think that is the correct answer. It's not the morally correct answer, but it is the correct answer in the context we're having this conversation. It is amazing to me that you can look at it and say, you know what, here's this piece of our history, this person who does not deserve to be honored, which is 100% true. He does not deserve to be honored with a statue outside of FedEx Field. He does not deserve to be honored with the Ring of Honor. Just being rich enough to buy and establish a football team or whatever it is, that shouldn't be enough anymore. And then turn around and play your games as the Washington Redskins. It is mind-boggling to me that Daniel Snyder can hold those two thoughts in his head at the same time.
If you follow the Redskins closely, and I have a few friends who are Redskins fans, they will tell you that nothing is mind-boggling when it comes to Daniel Snyder. That literally nothing that guy can do would surprise you. He's as my friend who's a diehard Redskins fan would say, he is a knucklehead with money, and there's nothing you can do to change his mind. All right, coming up, baseball is a game of stats. Brian, we always like to compare records and numbers and stats. What do you do with stats in a 60-game season? In other words, if a guy hits 440, did he just become the first guy since Ted Williams in 1941 to hit 400? What if a guy has an ERA of 0.0, the Blutarski ERA? What do we do with that guy? We'll get into that coming up. Brian Kamenetsky in for Mace. I'm John Ireland, 710 ESPN. All right, Brian Kamenetsky in for Mace. I'm John Ireland. Mason and Ireland. And still to come, Radio Tinder. Alden Gonzalez, who covers the Dodgers, is going to join us. And we've got Game of Games today, a game written by Brian Kamenetsky. But, Brian, here's a question. What are we doing? You know, baseball fans are stat geeks. What do you do with stats in a 60-game season? For example, if Mike Trout hits 430 over the six, did he become the first player since Ted Williams to hit 400?
Yes. But, like, you know, I am not an asterisk guy. John, I do not believe in asterisks. I don't like asterisks. I think they're generally stupid. This could be a place where you apply them, though, because when you're talking about not counting stats, like, you know, if some guy manages to break the home run record in 60 games, you know, no asterisk there. That's pretty impressive. But if you break something that where the amount of games you play really matters, then it's a problem. Like, you can't compare hitting 400 for 60 games versus doing it for 154 or 162 or whatever season you're going to go back to. I think winning a championship doesn't come with an asterisk because everybody's playing under the same rules. And there have been strike shortened seasons before and all that, but you can't compare the highest batting average of all time or a statistical benchmark like 400 when you're playing 100 fewer games. I would give him credit for doing it, but I wouldn't consider it the same thing.
How many home runs wins the home run title for the season? If they're playing 60 games, does anybody hit 30? Lindsay, you think anyone hits 30?
No, I think like 20 is probably the benchmark. I don't think anyone will hit 30.
I think Mookie Betts hits 40.
There you go. There's some optimism we're looking for.
Somebody, you know, it wouldn't be the first time somebody got really hot. I don't know if it's something we can look up, but I know that guys, you know, because guys at the beginning of a season have like gotten red hot and then calmed down. So I wouldn't be shocked if somebody hit 30.
I would. That's I feel like 30 is quite a milestone. Yeah, in a regular season.
I mean, John, that's like hitting 81 in a regular season, which didn't happen even back when guys were, you know, pumping up with the roids on their way to home plate.
How many wins do you think the team with the best record has?
44. I'll say 44 and 16.
ESPN did a record. They asked some of these questions, and the best 50-game stretches over the past 3 years were the Dodgers in 2017. Remember they had that stretch where they were 43-7? I don't think anybody's
winning. Right, exactly.
Yeah. I don't think anybody's going that hot, but wow. You're going to win.
Here's the thing. Like the modeling or whatever would say, like, you know, the best team over, you know, you win 39 games or 41 or 42 or whatever, but there's always one team that's way beyond what should be sort of statistically normal, which is why, again, a team like the Dodgers, a team like the Yankees, the Red Sox, some of these other teams that are, you know, the Astros that are everybody thinks have a good chance to win. Some of these teams aren't going to get in because they're going to have a stretch where they go 10-10 when they're supposed to go, 15-5. And that's going to be enough to keep them out because the Reds or some stupid random team are playing way above their heads. Like the postseason is going to look really weird in baseball this year.
All right. So back to the home run thing. In the past four seasons where a lot of people think the ball has been juiced, there have been 520 homer hitters in the season's first 60 games. Christian Yelich, Cody Bellinger, Aaron Judge, Pete Alonso, Mark Trumbo. So 20, you're right, Lindsay, 20 is probably going to be the number. 20 home runs in 16 games, or in 60 games. But I wonder how many wins. Like, the best pitcher is going to have how many wins? 10? 12?
I think if somebody gets to 10, that would be pretty surprising. 7 or 8 probably does the trick.
Well, Gerrit Cole won his last 16 starts last year.
That was pretty good.
So if he won all his starts, he'd be 12, but he's due to lose. I almost think you have to throw out the stats for one season.
I just think they're going to be fun. I think they're going to be, you're going to have all of these, like, to me, in a normal baseball season, which I think is 1,000% too long, I like, my favorite part of the year is the first week of the season where, you know, one guy has 9 RBIs in the first 3 games and you can get out there and say, you know, Mookie Betts is on pace for 643 RBIs. Like, I like that. Those are my favorite times. You know, this guy's on pace for 193 home runs. And then the season kind of, you know, you get to like June and it's, And then you get into the fall and it gets great again. So what we have here for 60 games is kind of like a season of that, where you get to have lots of fun with this guy would have if the game, if the season had been normal. You know, Mike Trout would have hit 133 home runs or something crazy like that. That's what I want to see.
So, you know, the other day, I can't remember, Brian, if you were here or if I did this before you, you filled in. I was throwing around, you know, you were here when I was throwing around my crazy idea about using your starting pitcher as basically a reliever.
Yeah, not so crazy. Not so crazy, I don't
think.
It's
now being kicked around like by people that know what they're talking about, including David Schoenfeld, who writes for ESPN. Schoenfeld, like, actually kind of extrapolated what I was trying to do and came up with like the exact way you would do this. He says, use tandem starters early on, three innings apiece, then use them again in a few days. He says a more likely strategy is use your best reliever more often. Without worrying about a 6-month season, how many innings can he pitch in 2 months? Certainly one inning every two games, and I'd say even more than that. How about 40 innings in 60 games, 20 innings a month? I really think it could happen. I think that we may see, like, guys, especially in the beginning of the season, guys like Walker Buehler and Clayton Kershaw are only going to pitch 3 to 4 innings anyway. Why not bring them back 3 days later? What's the harm in that?
Obviously with Walker Buehler, you got to be careful, but like the big picture question you're asking, I think you're going to see all kinds of stuff like this, John, because, you know, the schedule is compressed. You know, every game is incredibly important. So, you know, you don't have the luxury of, you know, giving guys extra days or like letting a guy work into shape or whatever it might be. So, you know, you have to figure out what is the best way for me to win today. What is the best way for me to get the most out of every good player I have on my roster over 60 games? And that probably means not letting, you know, one guy only see the field 10 times. And it just doesn't make sense if you have this premier arm to only put it out on the field for 10 games, 9 games, 11 games out of the season, when every game matters so much more than it does during a normal season.
By the way, Lindsay sent me a story today that was on Dodgers Nation. That Vegas has the Dodgers winning close to 38 games. And they play in the National League West because of these weird schedules, Brian, that they're going to play geographic, that they're going to play, they're going to play the National League West, and then they're going to play the American League West. The Dodgers have one of the easiest schedules in all of baseball. So when they factored in strength of schedule, the Dodgers ended up with the fourth weakest schedule in all of baseball. So they got all that going for them too. So they can, you know, they don't have to necessarily burn out all their pitchers early because they're not going to be playing teams that are that great. Now they're, like you said, there could be a fluke team. There could be a surprise, but the Dodgers have a lot going for them. They got Mookie Betts now. They get to go deep and they have a deep roster and they have the fourth easiest schedule in all of baseball. It's something weird would happen for them not to make the playoffs, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, look, the talent that they have should get them through, but it matters more over 162 games. Like, you have the Dodgers, the superiority of the Dodgers means more the more games you play, because small sample sizes give you weird results. And so that's why best of five, that's why the playoffs in baseball are always a crapshoot. And, you know, best of five series can go to any team, just because baseball is a game that's built on giant sample sizes and a long stretch of time to figure out who the best team is. And then the playoffs come around, and the first thing you do is compress this long-term game into a tiny little space. And that's why you get weird results in baseball. But I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm excited about what the baseball season is going to look like. It's going to be weird and fluky. And, you know, I think people like me, even people who love baseball, man, I really love baseball, I wouldn't mind seeing something a little shorter next year where they come back and say, hey, we learned something. Instead of 160, let's play 140 or 120. It'll never happen, but I would love to see something like that.
All right, still to come this hour, Radio Tinder, Alden Gonzalez, who covers the Dodgers, will join us on the show. Brian Kamenetsky in for Mace. I'm John Ireland. Mason in Ireland, 710 ESPN. All right, a couple of other notes we haven't mentioned today. Number one, Brian, Vince Carter officially announced his retirement today. Vince is 43. He played 22 seasons in the NBA. What's his legacy, in your opinion?
Oh, Hall of Famer. Underappreciated because his career lasted so long where he became kind of a role player. It's easy to forget just how good and how exciting and electric a player he was at his peak. But anyways, he's a surefire Hall of Famer, one of the great dudes, and one of the most fun players at his peak that the league had.
Is it hyperbole on my part to say maybe other than Dr. J, the greatest dunker in NBA history? Is there a better dunker than Vince Carter?
I'm not an expert here, but like, you know, maybe Dominique at his peak, Jordan at his peak, you know, Zach LaVine's really, but like, you know, Vince Carter is on the Mount Rushmore of that, I think. Like, he is one of the greats in that space. I mean, the dude, and I'm not talking about just like dunk contest dunks. I mean, like in games, doing stuff that were just incredible. I mean, you go back and if you haven't done it, if you're too young, whatever it might be, go YouTube Vince Carter. Spend 20 minutes, a half hour, 2 hours in that rabbit hole. It is worth it.
Yeah, he had one dunk against a guy named Frederick Weiss.
He sent him back to Europe.
Weiss was 7'2", and Carter just basically posterized him. I guess, I would Blake Griffin be on that list, too? Blake's a really good dunker.
At his peak, he was really good.
Yeah, but I wouldn't be surprised if we see Carter go to TNT or ESPN or one of those places. He's just really well-liked. He was the first star, Brian, that I associate with Toronto. I think that, you know, was there a big, like, Hall of Fame caliber all-star type player there before Vince Carter?
I don't think so. Yeah, well, now you got me curious. I want to look it up, but I don't think so.
Yeah, I think, you know, he's unbelievable. And if you're a fan of the EPL, the English Premier League, Liverpool, that's my aunt's favorite team. I got a bunch of aunts and uncles in Ireland. Liverpool won their first ever EPL title today. They've been in the league for 30
years. Oh, it finally
happened.
Good for them.
Yeah, 30 years, and they finally won a title. But I want to circle back to something we were talking about at the top of the show. I don't know. People ask me, I'm sure you get this too, when you're out and about or you're, you know, running around in the store or something like that. People say, is there going to be a baseball season? Are we going to see it? Is there going to be a basketball season? Is there going to be a football season? And I think there is going to be a basketball season. I think the NBA has done almost everything you can do to put yourselves in a position to at least start a season and see if you can make it through. My gut feeling, Brian, is that there won't be a football season, but that might just be me. I just think that football and COVID and social distancing are like opposites. I think it's just going to be really, really hard to pull off a football season. But baseball is the one that I think is now a coin flip. Yesterday, we had two guests on the show. We had CJ Nitkowski and we had Scott Boras. Scott is a baseball super agent. He's done more multi-million dollar contracts than anybody. CJ played in the big leagues and is now one of the announcers for the Rangers and works at MLB Network Radio. Both of those guys say that they talk to players every day, and they don't know one player who doesn't want to play. That every player they talk to says, we're playing, we're excited about it, we're going for it. But listen to Bob Costas. Bob was doing an interview today. Of course, Bob's a gigantic baseball fan. A lot of people think he'd be a great candidate for commissioner. And Bob kind of echoed the sentiments of Buster Olney when we had Buster on earlier in the week. Buster is very pessimistic that baseball's going to get their season off the ground. Here's Bob Costas today.
They have to be asking that very same question. It's the only question, really, now that since we're talking about baseball, they've worked out some kind of makeshift plan to play 60 games per team and get through some kind of season. But there are so many needles to thread between here and there. It's like a tightrope walk. Can you make it from one end of the ravine to the other? Yeah, but it's not guaranteed. And as more of these cases crop up, you see all the peril involved, not just to the season, but to the health of many of those involved. And I think what you're going to see in baseball and in other sports is players opting out, thinking it's not worth the risk either to them or to family members to play an abbreviated season.
Now, we've seen, Brian, basketball players opt out. Trevor Ariza has opted out. Avery Bradley's opted out. Davis Bertans has opted out. We haven't seen a lot of baseball players do that, if any. Do you agree with Costas? Do you think there will be a group of baseball players, maybe even some high-profile ones, who say, screw it, I'm not playing?
Yeah, I think there will be. I think when you look at the finances of it, there are guys who maybe made, you know, $10, $15, $20 million last year. They've got plenty of money in the bank, and you look at it, and whether it's because you have family members who are immunocompromised, or you have your relatives, you have whatever it might be, you're worried about the impact yourself, perhaps, of getting COVID and what the long-term impact of that could be. Because honestly, we don't know. And when you're a professional athlete, something that potentially threatens your lung function is more important than it might be to you or me, or, you know, the average person who worries about getting sick but doesn't need to rely on their body in that way to make their money. So I think you'll see players who decide it's not worth it, because it's just, you know, in their world, not necessarily that much money. But I think most players will go, and I think most players will try to do it to the best that they can. It's just a question of whether or not baseball can come up with a plan that works, that keeps players safe, that allows, for players to test positive, which will happen throughout a season, but still not make it so games have to be canceled and all this other stuff. If they can do that, then I think baseball will be able to play. We'll learn a lot in spring training, I think. You know, but I want there to be baseball. I want there to be all kinds of sports. And I'm just going to kind of let myself believe that they're going to happen. But some are more difficult than others. Like, John, you said no football. I'm not sure I'm willing to go there yet. But here's where I do think. I do not think there will be a 17-game season. But do you think there could be a 12-game season? You know, something like that.
Possibly. I'm not sure what that looks like or how you even execute it.
I don't know the math. I mean,
what do you think about college football?
Not a prayer. And I'll tell you, but that has nothing to do with the ability to do. I think the infrastructure is more difficult in college than it is in pros, because you just have more. You can kind of mandate more things of pro athletes than you can of college guys, because they're being paid. But the biggest thing is, I'm not sure you're going to be able to have a situation where students are able to be on campus in any meaningful way in the fall. And if that's the case, you can't make college athletes go out and play games, because that is just wildly exploitative, where, you know, it's not safe for them to go to class, but it is safe for them to go play football. Like, so that the university and the state and whatever can make money, there is a 0% chance that can fly. And so if you can't have students on campuses across the country, then you can't have college sports. And I don't think right now we're going to be in a place where enough schools and enough conferences are going to be able to do that. Like, what's going on in Florida right now is going to make it very difficult to have teams on campuses in Florida. So the college sports, I think, are in big trouble.
All right. So we've got a lot of professional sports teams in Los Angeles. We got the Rams, we got the Chargers, got the Lakers, got the Clippers, got the Kings, got the Ducks, got the Angels, got the Dodgers, got the Galaxy, got LAFC. I mean, we're loaded. In your opinion, Brian, we're sitting here on June 25th. Do any fans show up in any of those stadiums in the calendar year 2020?
In the year of our Lord? No. Any fans?
Yes. Rams are talking about socially distancing and bringing in 25,000
fans. I think there is a way where you might see fans put in stands. Now, it's going to be really tricky. Like, how do you do it? Do you make it so it's like a super premium product where, you know, you pay a little extra and you get to go in? Is it a lottery system? Is it whatever? I think what teams will probably do and probably should do is figure out ways with social distancing and all the appropriate protections to honor, you know, healthcare workers, teachers, you know, other first responders, you know, grocery store workers, all these people who have been out kind of in front helping us get through these, you know, the last few weeks and months, and let them come in and just watch a game. I don't think it necessarily helps the TV product. You know, you put 10,000 people into SoFi Stadium, it's still going to sound and feel empty. It might even feel stranger to have that few people there. But I do think there are ways that you could put people in the stands in ways that are relatively safe, pretty tasteful, and actually are kind of good for the community. So if that's part of your definition, yes. Full stands with paying customers, absolutely not.
All right. If you haven't heard Radio Tinder, it's next. Mason in Ireland, Brian Kamenetsky in for Mace. I'm John Ireland, 710 ESPN. All right, time for Radio Tinder. We just started this bit. Basically, I throw topics at Brian. He throws them at me. You can swipe left if you don't want, if you have no interest in it, then we just move on. Or you can swipe right and we get into it. I'll start. Brian, a company.
Remember, definitely not Fast Track. Go ahead.
a company has come out with a Grateful Dead deodorant. Swipe left or swipe right?
I want to hear more about Bill Walton. Swipe right.
Okay. This, according to the website, stereogum.com, a Grateful Dead deodorant has been announced. These are official Grateful Dead branded line of USDA certified organic deodorants. The collaboration includes five scents: Skull and Roses, Sunshine, Working Man's, Timber, and Unscented. They are all handmade in small batches using vegan edible ingredients. Brian, if there's one thing I don't really think I want to smell like, it's the Grateful Dead. Would you be willing to give Grateful Dead deodorant a shot?
You know, John, there are some times when you just want to feel like you're rolling into the parking lot with some patchouli and a couple veggie burritos that you just miracled off a dude next to you while you got your hula hoop and your tie dye. And so, yeah, there. I mean, this will remind me of college, late high school, college. I'll roll with some Grateful Dead deodorant. Why not?
When you
give me Working Man's, that's me.
Now,
Working Man's Grateful Dead deodorant.
Okay, I can tell you exactly what the ingredients are in Working Man. It's cedarwood and juniper. Does that work for you?
I think so. Lindsay, would you agree with me that I feel like I'm sort of a cedarwood and juniper kind of guy?
Sure. That sounds like it would smell delicious. And I don't mean delicious like I would eat it, but just delicious in a pleasant way.
Smelling kind of way, sure.
If I had to use the Grateful Dead deodorant, I would use Timber, which is a combination of Douglas fir and sage. But I think the idea of trying to smell like the Grateful Dead is just a bad idea any way you slice it. So I will pass.
Think of it as smelling more like Lakers practice in the Phil Jackson era. It might make you feel better.
There you go. You know, very, very well could be. Fudge.
All right, John, I have a story about American drinking habits during the pandemic. Swipe left or swipe right?
Oh, swipe right. I want to learn more because I've turned up my drinking, if you know what I mean.
I you think you just explained it.
Yeah.
So that wasn't very subtle. Do you think, though, more people are like you, John? Are people drinking more or less during the pandemic?
If my street is any type of an indicator, way more, not just a little more, way more drinking during the pandemic.
That is what I would have thought, too. But it turns out it's actually not correct. People are drinking less during the pandemic. They are buying more booze from grocers and liquor stores to drink at home, but it hasn't even come close to making up for the volume of alcohol that normally gets consumed when people are able to go to bars, restaurants, to, you know, sporting events and all these other things. So the level of alcohol consumption in the U.S. has plummeted. And people don't expect it to return to pre-COVID levels until 2024, which makes me worry that we're going to be virusy until then, because I don't know why people would. I feel like as soon as people can start going places again, they'll start drinking again. So I want to know what these people know that I don't.
Well, the consumption is hard to measure, because if they're buying more in the store, they could just be sitting at home getting drunk. But I would think just
They are. But like it's volume of everything. It's sales in stores plus sales to restaurants, sales at events, sales at everything. So the only thing that's gone up is sales so people can drink at home. And it hasn't nearly made up the gap with all the other stuff. It's basically gone down to zero. So we are drinking less in total.
I don't know. Let's just do a straw poll. Funches, are you drinking more or less since the pandemic started?
A lot more, and I'm not much of a drinker.
Yeah, Lindsay, more or less?
I don't drink, so the same.
Brian, more or less?
Less, but I'm doing way more cocaine.
Well, that's not good. I'm way more. I mean, it's not even, it's just ridiculous. So,
By the way, as it turns out, something else you can get delivered. You know what? The one thing that's gone up, there's one area of liquor that has been more popular during the pandemic. And I find this very disappointing, and I'm a little ashamed of America. Can you guess what it is?
No.
Non-alcoholic beer. It's the only place that's growing.
I find that to be a big waste.
It's just disappointing.
Yeah, but if I,
go hard or go home.
If I had given up alcohol, or if I was an alcoholic and I liked the taste of beer, well, who am I to rain on that person's parade? So there you go. Fudge. All right, Brian, director Joel Schumacher has died at the age of 80 after a year-long battle with cancer. He has a very eclectic group of movies, Swipe Left or Swipe Right.
What happens if I swipe left? Do you have to go to another
story? I just move on to the next story, yeah. Yeah, you can swipe left. You want to swipe left?
I will swipe left.
Okay. Mike Florio from Pro Football Talk says the NFL should have a secret team of 40 NFL-ready players who train and work out and can be called up by any team in case of a coronavirus outbreak. Swipe left or swipe right?
Swipe right. I want to know where these people are kept.
Okay. I had the exact same thought. So basically what he's suggesting is to take a page out of the XFL. The XFL did this because they didn't want a team to suffer a rash of injuries and not have enough people to field it. It was basically a league created as a television product. Florio said they also did this in the strike-shortened 87 season when the teams all used replacement players when their other employees were on strike. Florio points out that because coronavirus can affect anybody, he suggested that they have several rosters worth of players who are in shape and ready to go at a moment's notice. So in other words, you'd have an NFL camp. The XFL had an extra rosters of players and they called it Team 9. It had 40 players on the roster, and they shared facilities and medical staff with the Dallas Renegades. Teams had access to Team 9 videotape on a regular basis, and Team 9 put on full practices focusing on specific techniques and mental reps. So in other words, Brian, picture any sport. You can take baseball, football, basketball. It would be a team of players that would be run by the league. You would videotape all of their workouts. They would be doing basic plays and movements, and any team could access this pool of players. Would that work?
I think it's a smart idea. I mean, it's a little like what the G League was at the beginning, like before it became the thing that really spread around the league, where teams would share G League teams, and you could pull from, three or four teams might pull from one place. I like this idea. I think it's smart, but if you're going to play football, you are going to have, both for injury reasons and for COVID reasons, a pool of players that you can go to that you know have been following the same rules that everyone else has. Now, you're going to have to figure out how to pay these guys enough to make it worth it, but I suspect if you're on Team 9, for most of a season, you will end up on an NFL roster because somebody's going to need you. I think it's a great idea. I'm on board.
I do too. I think it'll work. Funch. All right, Brian, time for one more. It's yours.
I have a story, John, about hummingbirds?
Swipe left.
Left or swipe right?
Yeah, left. I don't want to.
Why do you hate hummingbirds? You got a problem with hummingbirds?
I have no problem.
I'm not into it today.
Yeah.
I have another story, John, about America's fascination with televised police officers. Swipe left or swipe right?
Let's swipe right on that.
Do you want to guess how many shows on the big four U.S. broadcast networks in the last year and a half, what percentage of them were about law enforcement? There are 69 shows, CBS, NBC, Fox, ABC. What percentage of them are about law enforcement?
I'm guessing a pretty healthy percentage. I'll say 27%.
It's higher. It's 35%. And this is kind of amazing, although not really, if you pay attention to CBS's demographic. What percentage of CBS's dramatic programming 2019-2020 were about police officers in one way, shape, or form?
Well, it sounds like you're taking me to a certain place. I'll say 40%.
70% of CBS's programming is about dramatic programming is about police officers. Here are the scripted dramas that are about cops on CBS. NCIS, NCIS Los Angeles, NCIS New Orleans, FBI, FBI Most Wanted, Blue Bloods, MacGyver, SWAT, Magnum PI, Ransom, The Code, Elementary, Instinct, Criminal Minds, Hawaii 5-0, Tommy. All of those shows are about police officers or law enforcement in one way or another. John, do you think as a country we might watch a few too many shows about law enforcement?
Yeah, it is because you could have death and you can have crime and you can tie it all together. I've told this story a bunch. I've probably told it when you've been on the air, so forgive me if you've heard this before, but someone in the audience hasn't. One of my favorite books about television is this book written by Bill Carter, who's the media columnist for the New York Times. He wrote it 20, maybe 25 years ago. It's called Desperate Networks. It's basically how shows get on the air. And it has each chapter, it has maybe 12 chapters, is about a different show. And how it's really a coin flip if your show ever gets on the air. And he tells one story that Les Moonves was running CBS, and the biggest show on CBS at the time was Everybody Loves Raymond. Remember that show with Ray Romano?
Yeah, funny.
Okay, so it was run by a guy named Phil Rosenthal. Phil was the showrunner for that show. So one night, he's over at CBS Radford in Studio City, and he sticks his head in Les Moonves' office, and Les goes, "Hey, Phil, what are you doing here?" He goes, "I'm just finishing up some stuff, just came by to say hi." He goes, "Well, I just got to poke my head in this meeting, and then I'm free. You want to go to dinner?" And Rosenthal goes, "Sure." He goes, "Okay, come with me to this meeting. It'll take 2 minutes." And Moonves walks in, and Rosenthal's with him, and it's all of his programming people. And they say, and Les Moonves says, "Okay, is the schedule locked for the fall season?" And his top programming people go, yeah, we're all set. He goes, "What do we decide on Friday nights at 10 o'clock? And they say, "We got a lawyer show with Tony Danza." And Phil Rosenthal, who's not even supposed to be in the meeting, says, "Oh, God, just kill me now." He goes, "How many failed shows has Tony Danza been on? What are you doing? Les, where's that show you showed me in your office 2 weeks ago with the lights and the cop cars and the sirens?" And Phil goes, "Well, yeah, what was that show?" And one of the people goes, "I got it right here." He goes, "Stick that show in the machine." This is back when you had VHS tapes.
Right.
Sticks it in, and it's the open to CSI. And Phil Rosenthal says, "Now that's a show I would watch." And because Moonves wanted to impress Rosenthal, he goes, "Let's do that instead." And the people in the room go, "Les, we've already agreed to contracts with Danza and his people. We would have to pay Danza." Les goes, "I don't care. Let's put that CSI thing on." It did gigantic numbers, so much
show.
They put it on the next night. It did even better numbers. This was the original with William Peterson. And then they franchised it, Brian, into like three CSI Miami, CSI New Orleans, CSI. It's made hundreds of millions of dollars. Doesn't get on the air if Phil Rosenthal doesn't go to dinner with Les Moonves and stick his head in his office. That's how
that is
weird
incredible.
TV is. All right, coming up next.
That's amazing.
Alden Gonzalez. Oh, there, by the way, if you, Brian, you would love that book. It's outdated, but if you want to, it would probably cost you like a dollar to get it now.
So am I. It's fine.
Okay. So I could talk for hours about this, but I'll tell you another story. So when Lost came out, the show Lost, there was a guy named Lloyd Braun running the network. And they told him, okay, your budget is like $500,000. And they went to Hawaii and shot this thing. And they went like, it cost them $1 million to shoot the pilot. He went $500,000 over. And the network said, Lloyd, if you do this again, you're fired. You went $500,000 over. He goes, yeah, but you got to see it. It's this great show. It's going to be a monster hit for us. I said, we don't care. You went $500,000 over budget. Don't do it again. They shoot a couple more episodes, goes same thing, like insanely over budget. And Lloyd Braun gets fired because he couldn't control the budget of Lost. The show airs, becomes a monster hit for ABC. They sneak him back onto the lot, Lloyd Braun back onto the lot, the producers of Lost, just so he could record one thing. And if you ever watch reruns of Lost, if you hear in the beginning, previously on Lost, that's Lloyd Braun, and it was a middle finger to ABC for firing the guy that went let him go over budget. That's the type of stories that are in that book. That book's great. All right, Alden Gonzalez, who covers the Dodgers for ESPN, will join us next. We also have Game of Games coming up next hour. Mason in Ireland, Brian in for Mace, 710 ESPN.
Geico knows there are many reasons why you ride. From the thrill of the revving engine and pure adrenaline of flying down the highway to the confidence of knowing that Geico always has your back with 24/7 access to claim service. But Ari Snyder has one reason in particular.
I have extremely large upper arms. They won't even fit into most shirts. Thankfully, biking really embraces vest culture, so I feel accepted.
Geico Motorcycle. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.